Before I put on my reporter's hat, I'd like to thank Paul for inviting me here as a guest poet. I have been here before. I went back a few years. I developed a bad hip and I don't travel so much of late. I just mentioned the bad hip because I actually have a poem about a bad hip. I had an operation for it done. It wasn't successful in 2010. And the only thing that came back in Shanachie Hospital, the only thing good that came out of it, I think, was actually this poem. It's called Dr. Carroll's Relaxant. Dr. Carroll is obviously the anesthetist. No doubt would you knew that I was fasting, easily cajoled to try anything, as you shook my hand, announcing yourself, outlining what you were going to be doing. In so many words, it came down to one. What you were offering was divine. And if that wasn't enough, an anecdote, how others whom you'd injected with your stuff wanted to take some home, a second helping. You were convincing, just seconds needling under my gown on loan to cover everything worth bringing along on my knockout trip. Settling down, I looked up at the ceiling, could overhear probably the tower looking for clearance. Are we ready, everybody? The theatre speeding up along the runway. Dr. Carroll checking if everything was okay. The plane climbing, not a cloud in sight. Me under control in the cockpit, high a Pentine high on my divine breakfast, as near to my maker as I could hope to get. So hurrah to the blue sky of the summer morning, looking down on Shanachie's orthopedics, hip decision to stitch the joint on my left. I have a food market at home, and my first collection, I call this My Register, and indeed my poem in it called My Register is such a mission statement of business I'm in, and I've used it as a cash register, because it's an IT system now we use as a measure for poetry. May I cajole you to pause while I spell imagination, password that boots up my register, its original software, copyright of my muse. Hereafter, I'll craft its final lie down, there to point that I shall never die. And may I recognize such hardware as my plugged-in scanner, its spelt-out words, each lined up under prosody to brand a voice, to wonder with the formless, maybe, their accent, what if we hear, to save on my hardware screen. Now, may I challenge you to become Thomas the Apostle from the Gospel. Say, except I shall see the print, I will not believe. Then look here, a poem in the making, and to exaggerate its creation, to highlight our relative fear of strange, may I point your finger to the point, to the print, see where I've written down the wound word. Now you may listen to my voice, as it veers to wit, to wind up, and just as you proclaim, my Lord and my God, I press error correct. Give space to the nitty-gritty, to a revision. The journal roll assumes all of these takings, adding up what I have gathered, my Z-read at the end of the day. Not losing the password, I prepare to begin again, to make words happen, that you may believe in the print of this imagination. Now just to see the business in action, I have a poem called Handbag. It was inspired by a lady coming to the checkout one evening with a black pudding. And this is what happened. Handbag. She dug a corner that I couldn't see directly because I was pinned inside the counter, serving her in between the ID of her pickup, her one and only from the provisions cabinet beside the deli, her no-no, her love affair with her bane of a frying pan about to break out from the slim image in her head, her losing battle, her crisis leading her to concentrate, postpone the solution for comfort, for her Clonakilty black pudding, her puto gov, famous for a century, all of its 280 grams. It's destined to fill her belly and flash tonight a special at €2. Her handbag accommodated the devil in seconds. A natural fit for a lover to surrender her soul. A fallen angel about to pleasure herself with this bloody stick from the heart of West Cork. So she buried it under a disposable tissue, deep in her covert handbag. A bunch of keys inside, rattling like a long-term disturbed lodger, grumbling, making room for the no-good savoury dish. When I asked by any chance if she'd prefer a plastic, even a paper bag, for her tiny kilty black pudding, she fought in, raising the finger, "Will you shush, lad? Don't be long there. I'm going straight home with it." But as soon as she clasped the handbag, somebody lined up behind her, indifferent as cucumber, aubergine, bananas, boring exotic fruits in her basket. No handbag, sleeves of plastic in her purse. This poem is called Dangerous Liaisons, in my first collection. For some reason, as much as I got feedback from people who wouldn't generally be reading poetry, the ladies seem to love this poem. It's set in a situation where somebody's getting fake tan. Dangerous Liaison. Penning Studio. As if embarrassed, Violet whispered words to the effect that she could be selfish enough to fall in love just by lying naked on Ray's bare bed. A sufficient reason to luxuriate in her skin under that electric body of his, while he charged heat, missing none of her pores, still healthy cells. Her pre-washed skin, her moisturizer that softens all over, her windows for intimacy all goggled, just in case he'd venture too far. Liberated as she was, she still set him against the 30 minutes of her clock. Then alarmed, having enough, she'd stop him, her sweating reassuring. Tanya, her friend, had always been raving about Ray, always egging on Violet to try him out sometime, that he'd give her the colour to look perfect, with or without her little black number. That after a weekly half hour with him, she'd look even more seductive, that he'd heighten her self-esteem, that others would be jealous, Miss Inferior transformed to Miss Superior. Naturally, Ray was not for free. He charged a set fee. But she appreciated that his polish and his result were a fair measure for what she'd spend. Violet made a weekly appointment, and after announcing her arrival at reception, Ray's personal assistant, Regina, would usher her to Ray's room, fit for any queen, painted all over to a high sheen. Although the ultimate silent type, you couldn't miss this sunshine, impressive, standing erect, ready for action as soon as Violet disrobed. She didn't mind that Regina showed signs that she also loved Ray. Ray was especially popular with brides-to-be who wanted to look perfect on their wedding day, before they'd admit to forsaking all others, close their eyes, wear no more goggles, be patient for a change, show respect, love in the dark. However, if you ask them why they liked to spend time with Ray, to have a machine all over them, they'd look cut out, even coy, trying to distance themselves. They might even spurt out sounding apologetic that Ray was useful, but not quite right. No heart, just a bigger fake. One of the functions of poetry is to be irreverent anyway. This poem is called page 57. It's taken from Geoffrey Chaucer's tales. The title of the poem is Putting Right Geoffrey Chaucer's Faux Pas in the Nun's Priest Tale. I don't know if you're familiar with that particular tale, but it's set in the farmyard where Chanticleer the cock he has seven other hens in the yard with him, and he's very proud of his cock-a-doodle-doo. in the sidelines there's a fox who actually got to him and stopped him from getting his great cock-a-doodle-doo. So for centuries, I'm arguing the point, what would he have said if he was allowed to have that final cock-a-doodle-doo? Here let me take the fruit and leave the chaff, as bearded Chanticleer, back in the foul yard, struts between doodle-doos, Pertolotti by his side. And let me settle the unsettled to be fair, fill in Chaucer's faux pas that left the cock short. Now picture Chanticleer strutting, liberated under the first bush, his makeshift toilet. Casually bending forward, he picks up a grain of Lair's mash that lies hidden in some weeds. Now picture the coal stalker, the rustle without a rustle, the connoisseur of raw fowl, full of iniquity nearby, and lying hidden in a bed of York cabbages till noon, till Chanticleer spots him, becomes startled. Russell the sly flatters the cock to imitate, even outdo Chanticleer's late father's crow. He so excites Pertolotti's hand husband that for focus the cock stretches his neck, holding both eyes closed, still warming up his voice, gaining momentum. No longer able to hold back, the cold rustle, the spoil sport, the shagger, the pain in the neck, seizes the cock right there and then. Poor Chanticleer's climactic crow, stunted on paper for 6 centuries or more. So, my epiphany hatched out, now clear to see. Above all else, even the risk of death, I say, the nun's priest hero has a cockerel's right to be carried away, and no holds barred to free his rapture, his perfect cry, his long-held due unlocked for posterity, to have on record a posthumous statement, to be the proud cock who loves 7 hens, but especially to let it be known that all his cock-a-doodle-doos came down to "I most love you, fair Pertolotti." Here endeth my coup on the nun's priest. Serious for a minute. About page 76. We're at a funeral. In my first collection, I had a poem called Bat's Black Love, and it was about my uncle Bat, who had definitely had a love affair with his black hill and water car. So my uncle Dan. My uncle Matt was dead at the stage, but my uncle Dan was still alive, and he actually was fascinated by that poem. I said Dan and Matt were very close. But anyway, Dan duly died, and eventually time cut up with him. And on the night of the removal, my cousin Joan, who happens to be Dan's daughter, said that they were putting my collection, this one, into Dan's coffin. It's fascinating. It's tiresome doing that, but I presume it was related to the Bat's Black Love poem. Anyway, so that's the context. At the end of the removal, in memory of Dan Cronin. Father Frank blesses Dan, hands him over on this side of the river, remains to be seen no more. Everybody is standing, for going waving, many sobbing for their memories. Sharon couldn't care less that what I'd written lies closed on Dan's lap, that Dan would quote me on the boat to whoever would listen, that when they reach the other shore, he'll again want to open the one about Bat, his older brother, reading about his documented affair in 1963 with, of all things, a black hillman. It would continue to amuse Dan no end, and more so even as he pauses to remember the way Bat turned the crank, heaving it round and round. In between, he'd see old faces, gauge his generation waiting at the dock, and rest assured, someone will lift the lid, confide to Dan that the hillman is still running on the same page. Okay. amongst ourselves, seeing as we've been celebrating Yeats amongst others this year, when Yeats announced to us, was this poem was written a few years ago. I went to see the tower in summer of 1972. This is what happened. Amongst ourselves, as we travelled to the County Galway, we came to Kilcaston Cross, his country. You forgot what it says in the rule book about not slamming the brake. I mentioned, better to get there in one piece, don't you think? You suffered my words of reason until, look, the sign for the tower points to the right. By then you'd balanced all, brought all to mind, as decades melted in the July sun, and coming upon children riding on the pothole lane leading to Tour Valley Lee, you were delighted, nothing had changed. Marvelled that he'd breathed this very air, felt the presence of his shade as we walked from where you had passed the car to the tower. Apart from us, tourists had gone elsewhere. Our look as peace came dropping slow, although when we came to the door of the tower, it was locked and someone had pinned the notice, apologies, closed for renovations. Damn him and his renovations, you said. I suggested leaving a note. It would be more personal than a text. In it, you could tell him that we'd called. Mention the potholes as you were at it. My last point, back in, I think it was 2008, actually I think Paul was at it, when there were mini festival in the Castle on Tyne. A crowd of us from Limerick went, and it was rented to down the cheap, I suppose. So we were in this guest house where we were sleeping about four to a room. Anyway, on the second night I couldn't sleep, somebody was snoring and worse. Between drags in the smoking zone, rumours circulated of a death camp, an unmarked room in the basement. They said that after an open mic readings, your man would fold the cut poems, some marked rejections, some wilderness voices, and quietly incinerate them in the Reich tradition. Tonight he had brought his art to a new town, a room in Brighton Square in the Tyneside city of the Magpies. He was supposed to be on a cultural exchange. This sleeper, this Himmler, this Cribben who came out in his sleep enacting his final solution. Though the light of a full moon shone through the skylight, I could not fully detect the workings of his concentration. Besides, the artificial light was switched off and spare me, we were in separate beds. His glasses were on top of the locker, but whatever trick of the loop he used, it started with a sound like planes landing, then relief, the soul of a poem released. Apologists have offered explanations. Too much food, liquor, writer's block. His accent out of sync with the Geordies. This night too, Spain had beaten Russia with goal-scoring poetry, and memories of the old fascistas might have stirred a karmic imprint on his mind. I had been witness the previous night to similar putting down of his aborted art, but this time, as if resurrecting the destructive mark of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he farted with such curried relish it filled the room. A skunk poem, its unambiguous semantics, coded through the night, its message, insomniac, write about that.